Okay, this week's Parsha is Parsha's Bo. And we will begin on page 340. At this point in the Parsha, Moshe has approached Paro, and he told him about the plague of locusts that will strike the Egyptians. We're going to start from Pasuk Zayin. Vayomru avdei Paro elav, the servants of Paro said to him, Ad masa yiyazeh lanu l'mekesh, for how long will this be for us as an obstacle? Shalach esu anoshim, send out the men, v'yavdu es Hashem elokeihem, and let them serve Hashem their God. Hatarem teida, do you not yet know, ki avdu Mitzrayim, that Egypt is lost? V'yushav es Moshe ves Aaron el Paro. Moshe and Aaron were returned to Paro. Vayomer aleihem, and he said to them, Paro said to Moshe and Aaron, L'chu ivdu es Hashem elokeichem. Go serve Hashem your God. Mi v'mi ha'ochim, who's going? Vayomer Moshe, Moshe said, B'nareinu v'zkeneinu neleich, our youth and our elderly shall go, we shall go, b'vanenu v'vnoiseinu, with our sons, with our daughters, b'tzeneinu v'karenu neleich, with our sheep, with our cattle, we shall go, ki chak Hashem lanu, for it is a festival to Hashem for us. Vayomer aleihem, he said to them, Yichein Hashem yuachem, Hashem shall be with you, kasher ashalach eschem estatchem, like I will send you and your children. Ru'u kiro ameged p'neichem, see that there is evil waiting out, that evil is out there to greet you. Lo'ichein natso, l'chuno ha'gavarim v'vdu es Hashem, let only the men go and serve God, ki oiso atem b'vachshem, that is what you are asking for. Vayigarash esameis p'nei Paro, and he chased them out from in front of Paro. The Beis Levi asks, how come at this point we find Paro chasing out Moshe and Aaron, but by all the other plagues, he doesn't chase them out? After Moshe tells Paro about Dam, Tzvardeya, Kinim, you don't find that Hashem, that we don't find the Torah saying that Paro chased them out. After this warning, and again after discussion, Paro chases them out. What was the urgency to chase them out? So the Beis Levi explains what's going on is like this. And he also uses this to explain the Pasuk Ches that it says, Vayushav es Moshav es Aaron el Paro. Moshe and Aaron returned to Paro. The servants of Paro said to Paro, look, you know, don't you realize that, you know, we're being destroyed? Shalach es ha'anashim v'yavdu es Hashem elokeihem. Send out the anashim, send out the men, and let them serve Hashem. Let them serve Hashem their God. By the fact that the servants of Paro used the word shalach es ha'anashim, send out the men, that the servants of Paro were saying, look, they're looking to serve God, let the men go out and serve God. This is what the servants of Paro were demanding for Paro. And Paro really, as much as he didn't want to do this, Paro had to acquiesce to his servants. The pressure was too much. The people around him were pressuring him too much. He could not push them off anymore. They said, let the men go out and serve. Let the men go out and serve God. Paro had no more choice. He couldn't fight back. Vayushav es Moshe ves Aaron el Paro. Moshe and Aaron were returned to Paro. That has a connotation of, as the Beis Levi says, they were returned to Paro means Paro didn't really want them coming back. Paro on his own point, he didn't want to talk to them. But he had no choice. They were brought back to Paro. Means they were brought back to Paro against his will. Because he had his hands tied. The pressure from the servants was too much. So what does Paro say to Moshe and Aaron? He says to them, okay, who's going? What did Moshe answer? Moshe says, everybody's going. Paro says, no, only the men should go. And by saying that, Paro now has done what his servants want. Because the servants said, shalach es ha'anashim. The servants said, send out the men. And Paro says to Moshe, the only ones that can go are the men. He's doing what his servants want. He's done what they want. But Moshe wants more. So now Paro has the right to refuse Moshe's request because he wants more than what the servants were asking for. But before Moshe could have a chance to change his mind and say, you know what, maybe that's not a bad idea. We'll let the men go out. And if Moshe changes his mind, he'll have to give in because that's what the servants want. So what did Paro make sure to do before anything changes? By Yigarash Hashem, he chased them out. He made sure that they had no Moshe should have no chance, no opportunity to change his mind, which would then force him to listen to his servants and let the men go out to serve Hashem. So the Bnei Yisrael is explaining here that we have Paro, his arm being twisted by his servants, but they only say, let the men go out. Moshe wants more, therefore Paro has fulfilled his part of satisfying his servants, and he chases out Moshe, which we find nowhere else, because he doesn't want Moshe to change his mind. Because if Moshe changes his mind and says, okay, only the men, Paro's going to have to listen. Okay, that's the first thought for tonight. The next thing I want to share with you is on page 346, top of the page, Perikud Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Oid nega echad odi al Paray. One more plague I shall bring upon Paray, va'al Mitzrayim, and upon Egypt. Achrei chen yishalach haschem yizeh. After this, he shall send you out from here. Kishalchai, and when he sends you, kala goresh goresh haschem yizeh. Completely, he will chase you out from this place. Please speak in the ears of the people. And a man shall ask from his friend, and a woman shall ask from her friend, vessels of silver and gold. And Hashem gave the favor of the people in the eyes of Egypt. Also the man Moshe, Godol Ma'id Beretz Mitzrayim, was very great in the land of Egypt. Be'enei Adei Farai, in the eyes of the servants of Paray, U'b'nei Ha'am, and in the eyes of the people. So Moshe is to tell the people to ask for the gold and silver from the Egyptians. And the Torah tells us that when the Jewish people asked the Egyptians for the gold and silver, Hashem gave the favor of the nation in the eyes of the Egyptians. The Jewish people found favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. The Egyptians willingly and graciously gave them the articles. And also the man, Moshe, was very great in the land of Egypt in the eyes of Pharaoh's servants and in the eyes of the people. It's very interesting that Moshe here is called Gam Ha'ish Moshe, also the man Moshe. Clearly, there's a certain chen, a certain favor that the Jewish people, Hashem is giving to the eyes of the Hashem is giving the favor of the Jewish people in the eyes of the Egyptians. This sounds like a special act from Hashem of the Jews finding favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. And then it also says Moshe was very great. Moshe was great. The man Moshe was great in the eyes of Pharaoh's servants, in the eyes of the people. So first of all, it's interesting to point out that, you know, after the word Mitzrayim, there's an Esnachta. That's one of the cancellation. But an Esnachta actually means to break things up. It's a pause. It breaks up the wording. So what really comes out is that the favor of the Jewish people in the eyes of the Egyptians that Hashem gave, that was a special gift that Hashem gave the Jewish people, naturally it wouldn't have happened. It happened because Hashem gave their favor into the eyes of the Egyptians. The greatness of Moshe isn't because Hashem gave his greatness into the eyes of the Egyptians. The Egyptians recognize his greatness. And Moshe is called Ha'ish Moshe. The man Moshe is great. Why is that word Ish there, the man Moshe? So the Rosh HaChacham explains in a very interesting way. Looking at the times that Moshe finds himself in, and this was applicable for many generations later, there are two ways for a person to become respected into the eyes of people. A person can either be respected because of the kind of person that they are. They are very wise, they are very refined, they're merciful, they're good, they're kind. All around, they are a complete person. Now, the truth is that that kind of wise and refined person is more appreciated or more recognized by the intellectuals of society, by the people in society that are themselves educated and wise and bright. They recognize a person's greatness. They recognize his wisdom. They recognize and appreciate more how he uses his wisdom. They recognize and appreciate his character. What we call the Hamainam, the general populace, if they're not especially educated, if they're a simple people, they might not recognize, they may not be able to appreciate this person fully. But because, so to speak, the wise people of the society recognize the greatness of this person, and they talk up the greatness of this person amongst the masses learn to appreciate this person also, to respect this person too. By being told by those who appreciate the greatness of this person that this person is great, the common folk also hold this person in high esteem. Then you have another person held in high esteem because he does wondrous things. He's got certain supernatural powers. He's got certain kinds of wisdom and a certain wisdom in which he engages certain supernatural powers. He does wonders. And because of the wonders that he does, it's really the common folk that are like really wowed by it. They look at it, they see it, and they're wowed by what he does. The intellectuals, the people of a higher class, you know, they see that the kind of wild stuff that he does. They're not necessarily that, you know, they don't necessarily get convinced by that alone, because, you know, where is he coming from? What's really this person's strength? But, you know, the more the common folk hold a person in high esteem, even those of a higher class, you know, they start thinking, you know, maybe there is really something to this person. So the person who is great because of the kind of person that he is, his greatness, so to speak, starts from the people on a higher level, and it kind of trickles down to people on a lower level. The wonder person, the person that does the miracles and the wonders, sometimes very often his respect starts from the common folk, from the people who are wowed by these kinds of things. And the more people that are wowed by him, the more that kind of influences even the people of a higher class to accept him as a great person also. Moshe Rabbeinu really was both. Moshe Rabbeinu, as the agent of Hashem, was doing wonders, was doing miracles. And the truth is that the wise men of Paro, Paro's magicians, at first, they didn't want to be wowed by it. They really wanted to say, well, you know, he's a sorcerer, we're sorcerers, he's a sorcerer. You know, they weren't necessarily impressed. At a certain point of time, they realized that his power is greater than their power. But Moshe, we also know, was the complete person. His wisdom was complete. His character was refined and complete. It was very well recognized by everyone what kind of a mensch, what kind of a person he was. Now again, the people who would really appreciate Moshe's greatness as a person were the wise men of Paro. The wise men of Paro had an appreciation for intellect, for character. They were the ones who appreciated Moshe more. And they appreciated him first, and based on what they said and what they spoke about Moshe, the people also appreciated him. But the point of the pasuk by calling Moshe Ha'ish Moshe is to say that Moshe's greatness was recognized as an ish. At this point of time when he's leaving Egypt, we're holding by the last plague, Moshe's greatness at the end in the eyes of the Egyptians is a greatness because he's Ha'ish Moshe, because of the man Moshe. Because everyone recognizes his wisdom, his character, his character traits, what kind of a kind and giving person he was. We could add a person who didn't gloat over the fact that he had brought these punishments about the Egyptians. He was Hashem's agent. He did what Hashem wanted him to do, and that's why he was doing it, no other reason. So therefore, Gam Ha'ish Moshe, even the man Moshe, is gadol. He's great in the land of Egypt. He's great because he's recognized as great. He doesn't need Hashem to make any kind of step to give his favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. They recognize him. Be'enei avdei Paro, in the eyes of the servants of Paro, they truly appreciate Moshe's completeness as a human being. U'be'enei ha'am, in the eyes of the people. The people may not, the common folk may not be great enough to appreciate who Moshe was, but even they recognize Moshe. And perhaps in this context, it's just not just in the context of what they heard from the wise men, but what they saw of Moshe. A person who is a complete person, a person who is great because he's a great person, everybody recognized that. Anybody can recognize that. So clearly, the servants of Parah mentioned first, they recognized Moshe's greatness as a person first. They recognized it at a higher level. But he's gadol b'nei ha'am. He's great as an ish, as a person, in the eyes of the people. The common Egyptian also recognizes what kind of refined and great person Moshe is. Therefore, when the Torah is talking about Moshe here, it stresses ha'ish Moshe. Moshe is held in high esteem, not because of the miracles that he does, but ha'ish Moshe. He is held in high esteem even in the eyes of the Egyptians because of the ish, because of the person that he is, because of his wisdom, how he uses his wisdom, his character, his good traits, his kindness, and his sincerity. Okay. Now, the plague of the firstborn, Moshe warns Paro about the plague of the firstborn. Paro's heart is hardened. Hashem gives Moshe the mitzvah of the Karban Pesach. The Torah tells us after Moshe is given the laws of the Karban Pesach, at least a good amount of the laws, and about the holiday of Pesach, Moshe tells the Jewish people, the elders of the Jewish people, to tell the Jewish people that they have to take a lamb, each family should take a lamb, they're going to shecht it as a Pesach sacrifice. And then to take the blood of the Pesach sacrifice and smear it on the doorposts and on the lintel, so that when the plague of the firstborn takes place, the firstborn of the Jewish people will not be killed. The Torah tells us how the plague takes place, how the Jewish people are then sent out to freedom. Page 360. Pasuk Mem Gimel, third line from the top. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe v'Aaron. And Hashem says to Moshe and to Aaron, Zoy Sukkas HaPasach. This is the decree of the Pesach sacrifice. Kol Benecha v'Yechavoy. Any person who is alienated, any person, as Rashi explains, who his actions are estranged to Hashem, lo yechabai, he cannot partake of the Karban Pesach. V'cholevedish miknas kasef, and any servant of a man that is purchased, umalta oisei, and you circumcise him, azeichabai, then he will be able to eat from it. So here is the here we have the Torah mentioning that if your servant, if your slave is going to eat from the Karban Pesach, he has to have a bris. He has to be circumcised in order for him to do so. If you purchased him, but you haven't yet circumcised him, he can't eat from the Karban Pesach. In Pasuk Memches, again, V'chol Orel Lo Yechabai, again the Torah stresses, an Orel, an uncircumcised person cannot eat from it. Rashi tells us the uncircumcised person in this Pasuk that cannot eat from the Karban Pesach is not just someone who doesn't perform the Karban Pesach, the bris meal on himself. We're not just talking about a person who doesn't allow himself for a bris mila to be done on him. It's talking about a person who actually is exempt from having a bris mila because of the fact that, how does this make sure I just guessed the halacha right? Right. I'm not sure how many this is, but if a person's, it says, right, his brother. If let's say a baby born is born after another baby boy who died from his bris mila. They did a bris mila on the baby died. The next baby is exempt from bris mila. That's the halacha. I don't know. But we're talking about even someone that was exempt from having a bris mila, that person also cannot eat from the Karban Pesach. Not only someone who intentionally is not allowing a bris mila to be performed on him, but even someone who is exempt from having a bris mila performed on him, if you're an Oro, you can't eat from the Karban Pesach. The Medrash on this pasuk tells us something very interesting that was taking place at this point of time, that the mitzvah of Karban Pesach was given to the Jewish people, and as they were performing it. Okay. So the Medrash says like this: Rabbi Seinu Amru, our sages said, Lo yibikshu Yisrael amul b'Mitzrayim. The Jewish people did not want to circumcise their children in Egypt. Ela kulam biklu hamila b'mitzrayim. Chutz b'shifre shalevi. Everyone stopped performing bris mila on their children, except for the tribe of Levi. Those were the only ones. This had to do with either the assimilation of the Jewish people to the Egyptians, Rabbi Yaakov Gonetsky says that being uncircumcised, that was, by the Egyptians, that was a big honor. That meant that was status. And therefore, Jewish people were hesitant of performing this meal on their children. Okay? It came time to redeem the Jewish people from Egypt. Excuse me. But they didn't have a merit. Commentary of Eitz Yosef speaks out, although there's a famous saying from our sages that in the merit of four things the Jewish people were redeemed. They didn't change their names, their language, their clothing. Shinu Shlam, Babusham, Vashainam. Was it four or was it three? I only remember three offhand. There were four, but I can't remember the fourth. Shmam, Vashainam, Babusham. Can't remember the fourth. But we know our sages say they merited redemption because of the four things that they did, which would sound like they already had a merit for redemption. The Yosef explains, it's true.
What were the three?
They didn't change their names to Egyptian names. They didn't change their language, means they kept speaking Lashon Kodesh, and they didn't change their clothing. So even though the sages say that they had that merit to be redeemed, they still needed, the Yosef says, a mitzvah. They needed to do a mitzvah to be able to actually merit redemption. So, they didn't have a merit. Ma'asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so what did HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? He wants to redeem the Jewish people. He called to Moshe and he said, go circumcise them. You know what mitzvah they're going to have? Bris Milah. They haven't been doing it, and now Bris Milah is going to be that mitzvah, that performance of a mitzvah that will be the merit for them to be redeemed. Okay.
Do they intermarry?
It doesn't say that. I don't know if it says that they intermarried. I don't know if that's one of the things. Could be. And many people still would not agree to be circumcised. Hashem tells Moshe to go, and Midrash says, Harbe Mehen. I mean, clearly there are people who did agree, who did allow. But many of them did not accept upon themselves to have a bris milah. Kind of stuck. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shiyasa HaPesach. So plan B, what was the next stage? HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe and the Jewish people to offer the Karban Pesach, the Pesach sacrifice. The Kevin Sha'asa Moshe HaPesach, and once Moshe made his Karban Pesach, Goza HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Dalad Ruchay Sa'olam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu then decreed upon the four directions of the world, the Nesh Reis Began Eden, they were to blow in the Garden of Eden. Umin Arucha Shebegan Eden, and now from the wind coming out of the Garden of Eden, Hochu, those winds went. The Nidbeku Ba'aytzei HaPesach. And they now clung. They now became, they scented the carbon Pesach that Moshe Rabbeinu was making. Okay. And the scent of that scent of Gan Eden, the Moshe Rabbeinu's carbon Pesach, that went a far distance. Niskansu kol Yisrael etzel Moshe. All the Jewish people came to Moshe. Amule, they said to him, "V'vakasha mimcha, we ask of you, ha'chilonu v'pischacha, give us to eat from your carbon Pesach. B'tnei shayu ayeifu min aruach." The smell was killing them. The aroma of this carbon Pesach, the aroma of Gan Eden, it was wearing them out. So they all came begging Moshe to eat from his carbon Pesach. I don't know how everybody came from his carbon Pesach, but that's the Medrash says. Hoya Oymar Kadosh Baruch Hu. So what did Hashem say? Imeinatem Nemoilim. If you don't have a bris, Imeinatem Nemoilim. You can't eat from it. Shenemar Vayomer Hashem El Moshe Vel Aaron Zayis Shukas HaPesach. HaPesach. As the Pasuk says, this is the law of the Pesach, etc. Miyad Naslu Asman Walu. Alright, after that, they decided, they acquiesced, they gave in, and they allowed themselves to be circumcised. V'nit'arav dam ha-pesach b'dam ha-mila. And the blood of the carbon Pesach became mixed with the blood of the bris mila. V'akadosh Baruch Hu oyre v'neitach olecha v'echad v'nashkei mevarchu. V'akadosh Baruch Hu took every one of them, and he kissed him, and he blessed him. That's the Medrash tells us. That was going on. So again, The Jewish people, it was time Hashem wanted to redeem the Jewish people. But they needed a schus, they needed a merit. So what was the merit? The merit would be bris milah, which they did not perform. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe to go to the Jewish people, tell them to have a bris. Many of them don't listen. So what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? He gives the mitzvah of Karban Pesach. Moshe Rabbeinu does his Karban Pesach. This Karban Pesach has an aroma of Gan Eden that is just making everyone salivate. And they come over to Moshe, they say, please give us from your Karban Pesach. And what does Moshe say? You have a bris, you could have it. Without a bris, you can't have it. Okay? Which sounds like, you know, that was a good trick. That was a good way of forcing their hand. Okay? Then it says, the blood's mixed together. What does that mean? What's the point of that? What's the point of even saying that? And then it says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu went, and he took each one of them, each one of them had a bris, and he kissed them on the head, and he gave them a brach, and he gave them a blessing. Okay. Now, I think another thing that we need to discuss, a couple of points here. Clearly, Hashem, as the Medrash says, the Jewish people needed a tzchus. What would be the tzchus? Bris milah. Didn't want to do it. Because Baruch Hu twisted their arms. Big tzchus. Big tzchus. HaKadosh Baruch Hu looking for a tzchus. So now he decided, okay, can't get the tzchus, we'll do it anyway. But clearly, it must have been the merit, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu went to each one of them and kissed each one and blessed each one. I mean, if their arms were twisted like that, they were dying to eat. They were going crazy to eat, and that's why they gave in. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu still gives each person a kushaf and kebbel.
Many of them didn't give in.
No, but now everybody gave in.
Okay. I thought...
No, at this point, everybody's giving in. Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah, at this point, the point here is those who first didn't agree...
Mm-hmm.
Now they agreed. Why? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu basically did this what seems to be a trick. So is that still a schus? Each person deserves a kiss on the head for doing that? Now let me share with you a couple of thoughts from the Eitz Yosef here. Commentary here on the Medrash. So one of the things that the Eitz Yosef points out is that we should really have a problem here. When the Jewish people came to Moshe and asked Moshe that they should be able to eat from his Karban Pesach. So when did they approach him to do this? Was this on the night of Pesach? When they were all about to eat the Karban Pesach? That's when they approached him? There's a problem. The problem is what? No, well, when the Yudalad was prepared, and it was cooked on Yudalad, roasted on Yudalad, okay? But so I'm saying, when are they coming over to Moshe? If they're coming over to Moshe at night when it's time to eat, there's a problem. You can't do a bris milah at night. No. Can't do a bris milah at night. So, the bris milah didn't work. I mean, you know, Hashem is saying, you know, okay, so get a bris milah, then you can eat, but the bris milah you can't do at night. So, says the Eitz Yosef, so it didn't happen at night. It's on the 14th. When they're roasting the Karban Pesach, they're preparing the Karban Pesach, and this aroma is wafting through the camp, and so they want it. Now, or he says, they chase it, or he says, or actually points out something else. He points out, which again could answer this question also possibly, he points out that there was another problem here, that we have to say that there was something called Hayrasha. So to speak, there was a temporary exemption. There was a the Jewish people were permitted something to do at this point of time that typically is not permitted to do. There is another halacha about Karban Pesach, that if you want to eat from a Karban Pesach, you basically have to join a group and be part of that group by the shechita. That's the halacha. When you want to bring a Karban Pesach, whether you're bringing your own Karban Pesach, whether you're bringing as part of a group, the group has to be formed over this animal by the shechita. You have to be counted onto this animal by the shechita. And if you don't, you can't. You messed up. You missed out. So says the Eitz Yosef. These people are coming to Moshe and asking from his Karban Pesach. How can he from his Karban Pesach? It's clear it was after the shechita was done. That's not a question. It was after the shechita was done, and therefore if it was after the Shechita was done and they were never part of Moshe Rabbeinu's group, how could they eat from the Karban Pesach now? How could they eat from it? Must be, he says, that it was Hayra Asha. Typically, you need by the Shechita to be counted, you have to be officially part of the group when the Karban Pesach is being shechted. Clearly, that wasn't happening here. It wasn't happening here. And then he says that perhaps when they asked to eat from Moshe's Karban Pesach, they didn't mean to eat actually from his. They meant to eat from a Karban Pesach because they understood now they all, maybe this aroma went through all the Karban Pesachs, whatever it may be. So he says instead of eating from Moshe's, maybe they ate from others. But then he says, we know that the Jewish people were told that already from the 10th day of Nisan, they have to take their animal for the Karban Pesach and tie it to the bed. So no matter what they're doing now, whether they're eating from Moshe's carbon, they're eating from somebody else's carbon, you know, they didn't take an animal and tie it to the bedpost on the 10th of Nisan. They didn't do that. Says they, Joseph, that wasn't mandatory. You were supposed to do it that way, but it wasn't mandatory. Since it wasn't mandatory, even though they themselves had not taken the animal and tied it to the bed, they could still eat from the Karban Pesach. But it would seem that from the mere fact that the Jewish people have to come to Moshe and say, "Eat from our carbon. Eat from your carbon." Well, what about didn't they have a carbon? They didn't have their own carbon. And maybe you'll say, well, Moshe's carbon, that had the aroma of Gan Eden, so they don't want it from his. Okay, that would work if we're going to actually learn that they ate from Moshe's. But according to the second explanation of the Eitz Yosef, which is they weren't eating specifically from Moshe's, it was just a way of saying that they want to eat from carbon Pesach. Didn't they have a carbon, didn't they have their own carbon Pesach? The answer is simply that even though the way the Medrash says it, it's at this point, you know, it's at this point where they're coming to Moshe, where Hashem says the Pasuk of Zoschukas HaPasach, this is the law of Pesach, and it's here that it's mentioned without a bris milah, you can't eat from the Karban Pesach. So from the way the Medrash portrays it, it could have been that at first they didn't even know that someone without a bris milah can't eat from a Karban Pesach. They didn't know that. Okay? They didn't know. And they took a Karban Pesach, and now Moshe goes in and tells them, you know, hey, if you're an Olo, you can't eat from it. But again, if the point was that they didn't know that an Olo can eat from a Karban Pesach, and they had their own animals for a Karban Pesach, then why were they asking, what were they asking from Moshe? What now are they asking from Moshe? That Moshe has to say, well, if you're an Olo, you can't bring a Karban Pesach. I mean, at least according to the second explanation of the Eitz Yosef, that they were just asking in general to eat from a Karban Pesach, not Moshe Rabbeinu's specific one. Why are they asking that? They have their own. What's the problem? What's the problem? They have their own Karban Pesach, so what are they asking for?
He's telling them they can't eat it, even though they have it.
But what made them think they can't eat theirs?
He told them. Now he's telling them.
But why did they even bring it up to him? What brought them to say anything to Moshe about eating from it or not? Now, you'll say, well, the answer is the Reach Gan Eden. But if everybody had the animal already, then, again, what did this Reach Gan Eden do to make them say anything if they had their own animals? So the answer would simply be that this law, that if you didn't have a bris milah, you can eat from the Karban Pesach, they knew that already. Even though it's the way the Medrash portrays it, it would sound like, now is the first time he's saying it to them, but we could say no. It's not the first time he said it to them. He told it to them, and they knew it. They already knew that without a bris milah, they can't eat from the Karban Pesach. So they actually didn't take a Karban Pesach. But then when the Roman of Gan Eden started coming through, then they wanted to eat from a Karban Pesach. That's what got them to want to eat from a Karban Pesach. And Amosha says, without a bris milah, they can't eat from a Karban Pesach. And then they agreed to do it. Okay, so now we have a problem. But they, at the time of Shechita, they weren't included on that Karban Pesach. Eitz Yosef says, must have been a Hayru Asha. Must have been a special exemption, a temporary permission given that you can eat from the Karban Pesach, even though you weren't counted on in it at the time of Shechita. Okay. So what we have here is a situation where the Jewish people, because they refused to be circumcised, they could not bring the Korban Pesach. Hashem now went ahead and twisted their arms that they should have a bris milah so they could eat from the Korban Pesach. Okay. And then the Medrash says that the blood of the Pesach got mixed with the blood of milah. What's the point of that? So Joseph says a beautiful explanation. What he means to say is like this. The Jewish people had no problem with the Korban Pesach. They had no problem with it. It represented their redemption. They were fine. But they had a problem with having a bris milah. And the bris milah seemingly was forced upon them. The point of saying the blood of the Korban Pesach mixed with the blood of milah is a figurative way of saying that they both the Korban Pesach and their bris milah came the same. They became the same thing. The same way the Jewish people willingly and happily sacrificed the Korban Pesach, after they had their bris milah done, they were happy with what they did. They came to realize that this was the right thing to do. It wasn't just like, you know, after you eat your meal, you know, the two arms were twisted, they had the Korban Pesach, and they said, okay, what can we do? We were forced into it. No. Once the bris milah was done, they were happy with it. They accepted it. They realized it was the right thing. When the Medrash says the blood of the Pesach and the blood of the milah mixed together, it means they became one. They became the same. Both blood, both mitzvahs, were now in the hearts of the Jewish people. They were performed happily. They were performed sincerely. Therefore, HaKadosh Baruch went over to each one and gave him a kiss on the head. Because once they actually did the bris milah, and after they did the bris milah, they were happy they did it. They now realize it was the right thing to do, and their whole attitude now towards it was the same attitude they had towards the Korban Pesach. They were happy that it was done and performed. That was now their merit, and that was now why HaKadosh Baruch Hu kissed each one and blessed each one. What it means is that the Jewish people had that good in them. They had that innate good in them. They were the descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But they became slaves to the Egyptians, and that created this, so to speak, this shell around them, over their neshamas, that didn't allow their good to come out. That's why they couldn't do the bris milah. But once HaKadosh Baruch Hu helped them do the mitzvah, once HaKadosh Baruch Hu got them to do the bris milah, the good came out. The good came out of them. Their true, innate good came out, and they were happy it was done. They needed help. The Medrash is telling us that Hashem had so much mercy on the Jewish people and wanted so much to redeem them that he made sure it should happen. He knew they needed a merit and he made sure the merit should happen. And once the bris milah was done, the merit was there. Because once they got over the hump, so to speak, once the bris milah was done, once they did it, their innate good came out and they were able to accept and be happy that they did it. Okay, let's now go to the end of the parsha. And this would be on page 364. 364, Pasuk Yudalet. And it shall be when your son shall ask you tomorrow, saying, what is this? Sounds familiar? It's one of the questions at the Seder. The Amar to Elav, you shall say to him, B'chayzik Yad, with a strong hand, Chaytzeno Hashem Mitzrayim Beis Avadim. Hashem took us out from Egypt, from the house of slaves. Vayehi, and it was, Kikshafar Shalcheno, when Paro hardened his heart regarding sending us out, Vayarek Hashem ka b'char beretz Mitzrayim, Hashem killed the firstborn in the land of Egypt, v'b'char adav v'b'char behema, from the firstborn of a man to the firstborn of an animal, al kenani zaveach l'Hashem, therefore I offer to Hashem, kol petarechem atzcharim, all the firstborn, all the openings of all the male animals that open the womb, the chol b'char b'nai yefteh, and the firstborn of my sons I shall redeem. So let me share with you the Sephornu's interpretation to what's going on here. What is the question of mazais? What is that question? Is what is this? And the Sephornu says it's really a continuation from what was mentioned before. What was mentioned before was the mitzvah of peter chamor. The firstborn of people, you redeem. The firstborn of kosher animals, meaning of cattle, lamb, cows. What do you do with that? It's a sacrifice. The firstborn of a donkey, which is a not kosher animal, you redeem it with a lamb. And if you don't redeem it with a lamb, what do you do with it? You break its neck. So the son is asking like this. You know, I can get how you wanna give sanctity to an animal that you sacrifice. But a chamar is a not kosher animal. You can't sacrifice it. If the animal itself doesn't even get any sanctity, there's no sanctity to this animal. Yeah, there's a certain level. There is some kind of level of sanctity because you got to redeem it. But the child is bothered by it. But what's pshat, as we say? What is this? This animal is not kosher. So why am I so? And there's no real sanctity that comes onto it. So how do I understand it? What's that all about? What's that mitzvah all about? And then you tell me that if I don't go and redeem it with a lamb, I break its neck. What's going on here? Especially for an animal that's not even kosher, that no sanctity could come on it. What's the point of it? What's the answer? You'll save him. B'chayzik yad ha'itzyanu Hashem Mitzrayim. With a strong hand, Hashem took us out of Egypt. With whose strong hand? Says the Sephornu, the strong hand here is not Hashem's strong hand. It's the strong hand of the Egyptians. The Torah tells us that when the Jewish people left, the Egyptians chased them out. Right? That's how we have matzah. The Egyptians chased them out. But there's another part of the fact the Egyptians chased them out, says the Sephornu. The Egyptians pushed them out so fast that the Jewish people didn't have enough time to load themselves into wagons, which would have been the normal way of loading themselves up and getting out, especially in a hurry. It couldn't happen for some reason. Because of the rush, it couldn't happen. The only thing that was available to them was their donkeys. Donkeys don't move too fast. But guess what? A miracle took place with those donkeys. That they were able to get out in a hurry using donkeys. For some reason, they couldn't get the wagons together when they were being rushed out. But the donkeys, they were able to, and a miracle happened that with the donkeys, they were able to get out fast. And therefore, because of this miracle that took place with the donkeys, there's a certain level of sanctity that they have, that they have to be redeemed, they have to be recognized. Because a miracle, at the time when the Jewish people left Egypt, took place with those donkeys. Therefore, there's a sanctity to them, and therefore it's only proper before you actually will use them to redeem them. Okay, so now we understand why there is some sanctity to these animals. What's the business about if you don't redeem, that you have to redeem it with a lamb? If you don't redeem it with a lamb, then you break its neck. What's that all about? The answer is, when Paro made a difficult, was stubborn about sending us out, Hashem killed the firstborn of all of Egypt. Paro, we find in a pasuk in Yechezkel that Egypt is compared to a chamor, to a donkey. Okay? So the donkey represents Paro. Okay? The Jewish people, we find in verses, are compared to a lamb. Paro could have saved himself with the lamb. Paro the donkey could have saved himself if he would have let the lamb go. The lamb could have redeemed him. But because he refused to let the Jewish people go, because he refused to allow the lamb to redeem him, what happened? The firstborn were killed. So that's why the redemption of a chamar is done with either, again, redeeming the donkey with a lamb. That represents the idea that with Paro would have acquiesced by letting the Jewish people go, he would have been saved. And if you don't have the lamb, you break its neck. That represents no lamb, like Paro, no lamb. He didn't allow the lamb to redeem him. What happened? Be'arag Hashem, Hashem killed. So that part of the mitzvah is, again, remembering the interaction of Paro with the Jewish people. that would Paro have acquiesced, he would have been redeemed, he would have been saved. Because he did it, and when he didn't, when he did it, wasn't redeemed by the lamb, he was killed. Hashem killed the firstborn. Now, because Hashem killed the firstborn, and that plague of the firstborn should have killed the firstborn, Jewish firstborn also, as is discussed, okay? And Hashem allowed the firstborn to be saved. That now gave a sanctity to the firstborn of man. And that's the firstborn, and the firstborn of animals and the firstborn of men, to commemorate that. And the firstborn of animals, what do you do? Is Zeveach, bring it as a sacrifice. Okay? Now, so how did, so the Sephornu says, okay, the firstborn should have been, excuse me, they should have been killed. But Hashem skipped over them. So the Sephornu, the means by which Hashem was able to skip over them and not kill them, was because v'hitzilam b'amer shehikdishim lei, because Hashem sanctified the firstborn to him, that's why they were saved. The mechanism, so to speak, the means by which that Hashem could allow the firstborn to be saved was by sanctifying them to a point that the firstborn of the Jewish people, he says, are k'mo nazir m'yaser, they're like a nazir. We know a nazir as at a certain level of sanctity. He says they will be on the level of a nazir or more. Miuchadim l'avodas HaKel Yisbarach, designated to serve Hashem, va'asurim b'avodas hedyot, and be forbidden to do common work. The sanctity that the firstborn were given for them to be saved was a sanctity that should have said, all firstborn boys, all firstborn Jewish boys, their lives should be sanctified to God. Their lives should be designated to serving God, nothing else. Avodas Hedyot, common work, menial work, regular people behavior, actions, regular people's involvement in work. No, not the firstborn. That's the kind of sanctity that they got when they left Mitzrayim that would say that allowed them to survive. Therefore, what happens now? Therefore, says the Pasuk, the firstborn of the animals we sacrifice to commemorate this, they are to commemorate that sanctification. The firstborn of my sons, what do? I redeem them. And what do I accomplish by redeeming them? I accomplish by redeeming them so that they should be permitted to do mundane work. Now, this doesn't mean to say that a person who does not have a pinyan haben done on him, it's usher for him to go to work until he gets a pinyan haben. That's not what it means. Because there is no actual halacha like that. But what it does mean to say is that the sanctity that the firstborn got that saved them from being killed was a very high level of sanctity. And it's a sanctity that really says that a firstborn should be designated only to serve Hashem, and the redemption now says, now we can go back to regular. Again, it's not going to be mandatory in the sense of without it he can't work, but there is this kedusha, this innate kedusha within a person, of a firstborn rather, that says that he shouldn't be doing anything else but serving Hashem. He shouldn't be doing anything else. And the redemption is now an act that says, no, it's okay. He can even be involved in mundane endeavors. So that's how the Sephornu explains this last part of the Parsha. And he explains that the purpose of Pidyon HaBen, the mitzvah of redeeming the firstborn of a person, is for the purpose of, so to speak, redeeming him, taking off that sanctity that's on every firstborn that really should dictate that he should not be doing anything but serving Hashem.
That's why a later going doesn't
mean that because they're only... well, a Levi, I mean, again, it sounds like the type of work that he's talking about would have been a later schel. I mean, a Levi does a later schel.
But you don't do opinion.
You don't. But this is the reason, though, that Waitsworth is explaining what the point of the mitzvah is.
So you said
Levi... Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky asks that we find that there is a custom that when you do a pidyon haben, there's a custom that we do a meal in honor of the mitzvah. Now, typically, you know, you're doing a mitzvah, and there's a sudas mitzvah, a meal that accompanies a mitzvah. But the question he asks is, it would really seem that a pidyon haben is taking a person from a higher spiritual level to a lower spiritual level. Because, you know, listen, if he's not redeemed, it's inappropriate for him to do regular work. It's inappropriate. So, but, you know, people can't exist that way. They need to be able to give him the chance at least to do that. So we redeem him. So it doesn't seem like the redeeming is, you know, something to celebrate. It's necessary, but it doesn't need to be a reason to celebrate, because we're taking him from a higher level to a lower level. That's one question. Another question he asks is that we know that after a bris, when a bris is done, there is something that we all say together. We say, Kashem Shenichnas Labris, the same way that this child was brought to bris, Kain Yitarek Kanes Atara L'chupa L'masim Tevim, so too shall he be brought to Tara, Chupa, marriage, and good deeds. By a pidyon haben, there's a couple of words that's added. By a pidyon haben, we add another part. By a pidyon haben, we say, V'yikonis ha-haben l'chayim tevim, this child should enter a good life, l'toyer l'yira shemayim, to toyer in fear of God. Yehi ratzeh, may it be the will of Hashem, shekashem v'shenechnas l'pidyon, the same way he entered pidyon haben, can yikonis ha-toyer l'chupa l'chayim tevim, so too shall he enter toyer chupa and good deeds. There's something more that we add for the pidyon haben than by the bris. Why? So Rabbi Yaakov explains, based on this pornu, that the explanation is like this. Our problem was that it seems like we're lowering his level. We're taking him from a higher level of sanctity to a lower level of sanctity. The truth, says Rabbi Yaakov, is that if this person would be on this high level of sanctity, he actually would not have the ability to fulfill the mission of every person on this world. The Torah teaches us that in this world, our job is to sanctify the mundane. We don't look at ourselves as two separate parts, physical and spiritual. Physical is just physical, spiritual is just spiritual. The physical has no involvement in spiritual. On the contrary, the Torah has so much physical involvement in serving Hashem, is because the point is that we are a unit of physical and spiritual. Both are to be involved in the mitzvah, and both are to be sanctified. Which means that we're supposed to live within this world and to use in the service of Hashem and sanctify it. If this firstborn boy is sanctified to the point that he can't do mundane work, that he can't do, that his sanctity, would it be inappropriate for him to do anything but serving Hashem, then he is not having the chance to be involved in the physical and elevating it. And if, let's say, this is a person who chooses in his life to be, as we call it, a Yisachar, he's going to sit and learn all the time and just be involved in spirituality, okay. But this child who's born that way is forced. He doesn't even have a choice to do anything otherwise. So the point really is that the pidyon haben allows this child to really fulfill his mission in life. It really allows him to be involved in mundane physical activity and to elevate it. So it's a celebration. It's not that we're taking him away from a higher level. We're not focusing on the higher level to the lower level. But rather the point is, now that he's brought down to what we see a lower level, that now gives him the chance to elevate. Gives him the chance to elevate. It gives him a chance to elevate the physical. It gives him a chance to include everything about his physicality in service of Hashem. And that's what we're supposed to be doing. That is what our lives are about. And if he was born holy, he wouldn't have a choice. He would just be holy. That's it. He wouldn't have certain involvements in the physical world, and he'd have no chance to do anything otherwise. So the pidyon haben is a celebration that now this boy is going to have the chance to fulfill what a person is supposed to fulfill in this world. And therefore, the celebration is a celebration. At the same time, we are taking him down a level. That's what we're doing. And when we do that, we have to add an extra prayer. We have to add an extra prayer that he should have a good life, a Chaim Tevim should have a good life, a life of Tara, a life of Yiras Shamayim. Because now that he is being given that mission to elevate the physical and to actually sanctify the physical with his spiritual part, that's not a small feat. You need a lot of help to do that. And because that is what, that's the theme here. That's what's happening by the Pidyon HaBen. Therefore, here we give a special bracha. A special bracha that says he should have a good life, he should have a life of Terei Yireh Shamayim. Because since now the whole point is to actually bring him down to a lower level to build himself up, that's the point where we give a special tefillah and say that Hashem should help you be able to accomplish that.